as he says they are. I haven't seen any. I lace my shoes tightly. Mist curls in the street outside, hanging low along the brick canyon. Unlatching the front door, I grin when the cool air hits my skin. It smells like rain and thunder. As expected, Cal sits on the bottom step, legs stretched out on the narrow sidewalk. Still, my heart lurches in my chest at the sight of him. He yawns loudly in greeting, almost unhinging his jaw. "Come on," I chide him. "This is sleeping in for a soldier."
"That doesn't mean I don't prefer to sleep in when I can."
He stands with exaggerated annoyance, all but sticking his tongue out. "Feel free to go back to that little bunk room you insist on staying in at the barracks. You know, you'd get a bit more time if you moved to Officer's Row, or stopped running with me altogether." I shrug with a sly grin. Matching my smile, he tugs on the hem of my shirt, pulling me toward him.
"Don't insult my bunk room," he mutters,
before dropping a kiss on my lips, then my jaw, then my neck. Each touch blooms, a burst of fire beneath my skin. Reluctantly, I push his face away.
"There is a real possibility my dad shoots you from the window if you keep this up here."
"Right, right."
He recovers quickly, paling. If I didn't know any better, I'd say Cal was actually scared of my father. The thought is comical. A silver prince, a general, who can raise infernos with a flick of his fingers, afraid of a limping old red.
"Let's stretch."
We go through the motions, Cal more thoroughly than I. He scolds me gently, finding something wrong with every move.
"Don't lunge into it, don't rock back and forth. Easy. Slow."
But I'm eager, thirsty to run. Eventually, he relents. With a nod of his head, he lets us begin. At first, the pace is easy. I almost dance on my toes, exhilarated by the steps. They feel like freedom. The fresh air, the birds, the mist brushing past with damp fingers, my even, steady breath and steadily rising heartbeat. The first time we ran here, I had to stop and cry, too happy to stop the tears. Cal sets a good clip, keeping me from sprinting until my lungs give out. The first mile passes well enough, getting us to the perimeter wall. Half stone, half chain link, topped with razor wire, and a few soldiers patrol the far side. Montfort men. They nod to each of us, used to our route after 2 weeks. Other soldiers jog in the distance, running their usual training exercises, but we don't join them. They drill in rows, with shouting sergeants. It's not for me. Cal is demanding enough. And thankfully, Davidson hasn't pressed me on the whole resettlement or service choice. In fact, I haven't seen him since my debriefing, even though he now lives on base with the rest of us. The next 2 miles are more difficult. Cal pushes a harder pace. It's hotter today, even this early, with clouds gathering overhead. As the mist burns off, I sweat hard and salt collects on my lips. Legs pumping, I wipe my face on the hem of my shirt. Cal feels the heat, too. At my side, he just pulls his shirt off entirely, tucking it into the waistband of tight training pants. My first instinct is to warn him against sunburn. The second is to stop and stare at the well-defined muscles of his bare abdomen. Instead, I focus on the path before me, forcing another mile. Another. Another. His breathing beside me is suddenly very distracting. We round the shallow forest separating the barracks and Officers' Row from the airfield when thunder rumbles somewhere. A few miles away, certainly. Cal puts out an arm at the noise, slowing me down. He snaps to face me, both hands gripping my shoulders as he leans down to my eye level. Bronze eyes bore into mine, looking for something. The thunder rolls again, closer.
"What's wrong?"
he asks, all concern. One hand strays to my neck to soothe the scars burning red hot with exertion. "Calm down."
"That's not me."
I tip my head toward the darkening storm clouds with a smile.
"That's just weather.
Sometimes, when it gets too hot and humid, thunderstorms can..." He laughs. "Okay, I get it. Thank you."
"Ruining a perfectly good run,"
I tut, moving my hand to take his. He grins crookedly, smiling so wide it crinkles his eyes. As the storm moves closer, I feel its electric heart thrumming. My pulse steadies to match it,
but I push away the seductive purr of lightning. Can't let loose a storm so close. I have no control of rain, and it falls in a sudden curtain, making us both yelp. Whatever bits of my clothes weren't covered in sweat quickly soak through. The sudden cold is a shock to us both, Cal in particular. His bare skin steams, wrapping his torso and arms in a thin layer of gray mist. Raindrops hiss when they make contact, flash boiling. As he calms, it stops, but he still pulses with warmth. Without thought, I tuck into him, shivering down my spine. "We should go back," he mutters to the top of my head. I feel his voice reverberate in his chest, my palm flat to where his heart rips a fast tempo. It thunders under my touch, in stark contrast to his calm face. Something stops me from agreeing, another tug, deeper inside, somewhere I can't name. "Should we?" I whisper, expecting the rain to swallow my voice. His arms tighten around me. He didn't miss a word. The trees are new growth, their leaves and branches not splayed wide enough to offer total cover from the sky, but enough from the street. My shirt goes first, landing in mud. I toss his into the muck, too, just so we're even. Rain pelts down in fat drops, each one a cold surprise, to run down my nose or spine or my arms wrapped around his neck. Warm hands do battle across my back, a delightful opposite to the water. His fingers walk the length of my spine, pressing into each vertebra. I do the same, counting his ribs. He shivers, and not from the rain, as my nails scrape along his side. Cal responds with teeth. They graze the length of my jaw before finding my ear. I shut my eyes for a second, unable to do anything but feel. Every sensation is a firework, a thunderbolt, an explosion. The thunder gets closer, as if drawn to us. I run my fingers through his hair, using it to pull him closer. Closer, closer, closer. He tastes like salt and smoke. Closer. I can't seem to get close enough. "Have you done this before?" I should be afraid, but only the cold makes me shiver. He tips his head back, and I almost whine in protest. "No," he whispers, looking away. Dark lashes drip rain. His jaw tightens, as if ashamed. So like Cal, to feel embarrassment for something like this. He likes to know the end of a path, the answer to a question before asking. I almost laugh. This is a different kind of battle. There's no training, and instead of donning armor, we throw the rest of our clothes away. After 6 months of sitting by his brother's side, lending my entire being to an evil cause, I have no fear of giving my body to a person I love, even in the mud. Lightning flashes overhead and behind my eyes. Every nerve sparks to life. It takes all my concentration to keep Cal from feeling the wrong end of such things. His chest flushes beneath my palms, rising with reckless heat. His skin looks even paler next to mine. Using his teeth, he unlatches his flamemaker bracelets and tosses them into the undergrowth. "Thank my colors for the rain," he murmurs. I feel the opposite. I want to burn. I refuse to go back to the row house covered in mud, and due to Cal's oh-so-inconvenient living quarters, I can't clean off at his barracks unless I feel like sharing the showers with a dozen other soldiers. He picks leaves out of my hair as we walk toward the base hospital, a squat building overgrown with ivy.
"You look like a shrub," he says, sporting an almost manic smile.
"That's exactly what you're supposed to say."
Cal nearly giggles. "How would you know?"
I deflect, ducking into the entrance. The hospital is nearly deserted at this hour, staffed with a few nurses and doctors to oversee next to no patients. Healers make them mostly irrelevant, needed only for lengthy diseases or extremely complicated injuries. We walk the cinderblock halls alone, under harsh fluorescent lights and easy silence. My cheeks still burn as my mind does war with itself. Instinct makes me want to shove Cal into the nearest room and lock the door behind us. Sense tells me I cannot. I thought it would be different. I thought I would feel different. Cal's touch has not erased Maven's. My memories are still there, still just as painful as they were yesterday. And as much as I try, I have not forgotten the canyon that will always stretch between us. No kind of love can erase his faults, just like none can erase mine. A nurse with an armful of blankets rounds the corner ahead, her feet a blur over the tiled floor. She stops at the sight of us, almost dropping the linens.
"Oh," she says, "you're fast, Miss Barrow."
My flush intensifies as Cal quickly turns a laugh into a cough.
"Excuse me?" She grins. "We just sent a message to your home."
Follow me, sweetie. I'll take you to her." The nurse beckons, shifting the linens to her hip. Cal and I trade confused glances. He shrugs and trots after her, oddly carefree. His army-trained caution seems far away. The nurse chatters excitedly as we walk in her wake. Her accent is Piedmontese, making the words slower and sweeter.
"Shouldn't take long. She's progressing quickly. Soldier to the bone, I suppose. Doesn't want to waste any time."
Our hallway dead-ends into a larger ward, much busier than the rest of the hospital. Wide windows look out on yet another garden, now dark and lashed with rain. Piedmont certainly has a thing for flowers. Several doors branch off on either side, leading to empty rooms and empty beds. One of them is open, and more nurses flit in and out. An armed Scarlet Guard soldier keeps watch, although he doesn't look very alert. It's still early, and he blinks slowly, numbed by the quiet efficiency of the ward. Sarah Skonos looks awake enough for the two of them. Before I can call to her, she raises her head, eyes gray as the storm clouds outside. Julian was right. She has a lovely voice.
"Good morning," she says.
It's the first time I've ever heard her speak. I don't know her very well, but we embrace anyway. Her hands graze my bare arms, sending shooting stars of relief into overworked muscles. When she leans back, she pulls another leaf out of my hair, then demurely brushes mud from the back of my shoulder. Her eyes flicker, noting the mud streaking Cal's limbs. Next to the sterile atmosphere of the hospital, with its gleaming surfaces and bright lights, we stick out like a pair of very sore and dirty thumbs. Her lips twist into the slightest smirk. "I hope you enjoyed your morning run." Cal clears his throat, and his face flushes. He wipes a hand on his pants, but only succeeds in spreading the incriminating mud even more.
"Yeah."
Each of these rooms is equipped with a bathroom, including a shower. I can arrange for changes of clothes as well. Sarah points with her chin. "If you like." The prince ducks his face to hide his flush as it deepens. He slinks away, leaving a trail of wet footprints in his wake. I remain, letting him go on ahead. Even though she can speak again, her tongue returned by another skin healer, I assume, Sarah doesn't talk much. She has more meaningful ways to communicate. She touches my arm again, gently pushing me toward the open door. With Cal out of sight, I can think a little more clearly. The dots connect, one by one. Something tightens in my chest, an equal twist of sadness and excitement. I wish Shade were here. Farley sits up in the bed, her face red and swollen, a sheen of sweat across her brow. The thunder outside is gone, melting to a downpour of endless rain, weeping down the windows. She barks out a laugh at the sight of me, then winces at the sudden action. Sarah moves quickly to her side, putting soothing hands to Farley's cheeks. Another nurse idles against the wall, waiting to be useful.
"Did you run here or crawl through a sewer?" Farley asks over Sarah's fussing.
I move deeper into the room, careful not to get anything else dirty. "Got caught in the storm."
"Right."
She sounds entirely unconvinced.
"Was that Cal outside?"
My blush suddenly matches hers.
"Yes."
"Right," she says again, drawing out the word. Her eyes tick over me, as if she can read the last half hour on my skin. I fight the urge to check myself for any suspicious handprints. Then she reaches out, gesturing for the nurse. She leans down and Farley whispers in her ear, her words too fast and low for me to catch. The nurse nods, scurrying off to procure whatever Farley wants. She gives me a tight smile as she goes.
You can come closer. I'm not going to explode.
She glances up at Sarah. Yet. The skin healer offers a well-practiced, obliging smile.
It won't be long now.
Tentative. I take a few steps forward until I can reach out and take Farley's hand if I want to. A few machines blink at the side of her bed, pulsing slowly and quietly. They pull me in, hypnotic in their even rhythm. The ache for Shade multiplies. We're going to get a piece of him soon, but he's never coming back. Not even in a baby with his eyes, his name, his smile. A baby he will never get to love. I thought about Madeline. Her voice snaps me out of the spiral.
What?
Farley picks at her white bedspread. That was my sister's name.
Oh.
Last year I found a photo of her family in the colonel's office. It was taken years ago, but Farley and her father were unmistakable, posing next to her equally blonde mother and sister. All of them had a similar look, broad-shouldered, athletic, their eyes blue and steely. Farley's sister was the smallest of them all, still growing into her features.
Or Clara, after my mother.
If she wants to keep talking, I'm here to listen, but I won't pry, so I keep quiet, waiting, letting her lead the conversation.
They died a few years ago, back in the Lakelands, at home. Scarlet Guard wasn't so careful then, and one of our operatives was caught knowing too much.
Pain flickers across her face now and then, both from the memory and her current state.
Our village was small, overlooked, unimportant. The perfect place for something like the Guard to grow, until one man breathed its name under torture. The King of the Lakelands punished us himself.
The memory of him flashes through my mind, a small man, still and foreboding as the surface of undisturbed water.
Auric Signet.
My father and I were away when he raised the shores of the Hud, pulling water out of the bay to flood our village and wipe it from the face of his kingdom.
They drowned, I murmur.
Her voice never wavers. Reds across the country were inflamed by the drowning of the Northlands. My father told our story up and down the lakes, in too many villages and towns to count, and the Guard flourished.
Farley's empty expression becomes a scowl.
At least they died for something, he used to say. We could only be so lucky.
Better to live for something.
I agree. A lesson I learned the hard way.
Yes, exactly.
Exactly. She trails off, but she takes my hand without flinching.
So, how are you adjusting?
Slowly.
That's not a bad thing.
The family stays around the house most days. Julian visits when he isn't holed up in the base lab. Killorn is always around, too. Nurses come to work with my dad, get him readjusted to the leg. He's progressing beautifully, by the way, I add, looking back to Sarah, quiet in her corner. She beams, pleased. He's good at hiding what he feels, but I can tell he's happy, happy as he can be.
I didn't ask about your family. I asked about you.
Farley taps a finger against the inside of my wrist. In spite of myself, I flinch, remembering the weight of manacles.
For once, I'm giving you permission to whine about yourself, Lightning Girl.
I sigh. I can't be alone in rooms with locked doors.
I can't.
Slowly, I pull my wrist from her grasp. I don't like things on my wrists. It feels too much like the manacles Maven used to keep me a prisoner. And I can't see anything for what it is. I look for deceit everywhere, in everyone. Her eyes darken.
That's not necessarily a terrible instinct.
I know, I mutter.
What about Cal?
What about him?
The last time I saw you two together before all that,
you were inches from ripping each other to shreds,
and inches away from Shade's corpse.
I assume that's all settled.
I remember the moment. We haven't spoken of it.
My relief, our relief at my escape, pushed it far into the background, forgotten. But as Farley speaks, I feel the old wound reopen. I try to rationalize.
He is still here. He helped the guard raid Archeon. He led the takeover of Corvium. I only wanted him to choose a side, and he clearly has.
Words whisper in my ear, tugging on the back of a memory.
Choose me. Choose the Dawn.
He chose me. Took him long enough. I have to agree. But at least there's no turning him from this path now. Cal is the Scarlet Guard's. Maven made sure the country knew that.
I have to go clean up, if my brothers see me like this.
Go ahead.
Farley shifts against her raised pillows, trying to adjust into a more comfortable position.
You might have a niece or nephew by the time you get back.
Again, the thought is bittersweet. I force a smile, for her sake.
I wonder if the baby will be like Shade.
My meaning is obvious. Not in appearance, but ability.
Will their child be a new blood like he was and I am? Is that how this even works?
Farley just shrugs, understanding.
Well, it hasn't teleported out of me yet, so who knows?
At the door, her nurse returns, holding a shallow cup. I move back to let her pass, but she approaches me, not Farley.
The general asked me to get you this, she says, holding out the cup.
In it is a single pill, white, unassuming.
Your choice,
Farley says from the bed. Her eyes are grave as her hands cradle her stomach.
I thought you should have that, at least.
I don't hesitate. The pill goes down easily.
Some time later, I have a niece.
Mom refuses to let anyone else hold Clara. She claims to see Shade in the newborn, even though that's practically impossible. The little girl looks more like a wrinkled red tomato than any brother of mine. Out in the ward, the rest of the Barrows congregate in their excitement. Cal is gone, returning to his training schedule. He didn't want to intrude on a private family moment, giving me space as much as anyone else. Kaloran sits with me, cramped into a little chair against the windows. The rain weakens with every passing second.
Good time to fish, he says, glancing at the gray sky.
Oh, don't you start mumbling about the weather, too.
Touchy-touchy.
You're living on borrowed time, Warren. He laughs, rising to the joke.
I think we all are at this point.
From anyone else, it would sound foreboding, but I know Kaloran too well for that. I nudge his shoulder.
So how's training going?
Well, Montfort has dozens of new blood soldiers, all trained. Some abilities overlap. Darmian, Herrick, Farah, a few more. And they're improving by leaps and bounds with their mentors. I drill with Ada and the kids when Cal doesn't. They need a familiar face.
No time for fishing, then?
He chuckles, leaning forward to brace his elbows on his knees.
No, not really.
It's funny. I used to hate getting up to work the river. Hated every second of sunburns and rope burns and stuck hooks and fish guts all over my clothes.
He gnaws on his nails.
Now I miss it.
I miss that boy, too.
The smell made it really hard to be friends with you. Probably why we stuck together. No one else could handle my stink or your attitude.
I smile and tip my head back, leaning my skull against the window glass.
Raindrops roll past, fat and steady. I count them in my head. It's easier than thinking about anything else around me or ahead of me.
41. 42.
I didn't know you could sit still for this long.
Kaloran watches me, thoughtful. He's a thief, too, and he has a thief's instincts.
Lying to him won't accomplish anything, only push him farther away.
And that's not something I can bear right now.
I don't know what to do,
I whisper. Even in Whitefire, as a prisoner, I tried to escape, tried to scheme, spy, survive. But now, I don't know. I'm not sure I can continue.
You don't have to. No one on Earth would blame you if you walked away from all of this and never came back.
I keep staring at the raindrops. In the pit of my belly, I feel sick. I know. Guilt eats through me. But even if I could disappear right now, with everyone I care about, I wouldn't do it. There's too much anger in me. Too much hate. Killor nods in understanding. But you don't want to fight, either. I don't want to become... My voice trails away. I don't want to become a monster. A shell with nothing but ghosts. Like Maven.
You won't. I won't let you. And don't even get me started on Geesa.
In spite of myself, I bite back a laugh. Right. You're not alone in this. In all my work with the New Bloods, I found that's what they most fear. He leans his own head back against the window.
You should talk to them.
I should, I murmur, and I mean it. A tiny bit of relief blooms in my chest. Those words comfort me like nothing else.
And in the end, you need to figure out what you want.
He prods gently. Bathwater swirls, boiling lazily in fat white bubbles. A pale boy looks up at me, his eyes wide and his neck bared. In reality, I just stood. I was weak and stupid and scared. But in the daydream, I put my hands around his neck and squeeze. He flails in the scalding water, dipping under, never to resurface, never to haunt me again. I want to kill him. Killorn's eyes narrow as a muscle twinges in his cheek. Then you have to train, and you have to win. Slowly, I nod. At the edge of the ward, almost entirely in shadow, the colonel keeps vigil. He stares at his feet, not moving. He doesn't go in to see his daughter and new grandchild, but he doesn't leave either.
23. Evangeline. She laughs against my neck, her touch a brush of lips and cold steel. My crown perches precariously on her red curls, steel and diamond glinting between ruby locks. With her ability, she makes the diamonds wink like luminous stars. Reluctant, I sit up and leave my bed, the silky sheets, and Elaine behind. She yelps when I throw open the curtains, letting the sunlight stream in. With a flick of her hand, the window shadows, blooming with shade until the light reduces to her liking. I dress in the dimness, donning small black undergarments and a pair of laced sandals. Today is special, and I take my time molding an outfit to my form from the metal sheets in my closet. Titanium and darkened steel ripple across my limbs. Black and silver, it reflects light in an array of brilliant colors. I don't need a maid to complete my appearance, nor do I want one floating around in my room. I do it myself, matching sparkling blue-black lipstick to cold, dark eyeliner dotted with specially made crystals. Elaine dozes through it all, until I pull the crown from her head. It fits me perfectly. "Mine," I tell her, leaning down to kiss her once more. She smiles lazily, her lips curving against my own. "Don't forget, you're supposed to be present today." She bows playfully. "As your highness commands." The title is so delicious I want to lick the words right out of her mouth, but at the risk of ruining my makeup, I refrain. And I don't look back, lest I lose my grip on whatever self-control I have left these days. Ridge House has belonged to my family for generations, sprawling across the cresting edge of the many rifts that give our region its name. All steel and glass, it's easily my favorite of the family estates. My personal chambers face east, toward the dawn. I like rising with the sun, as much as Elaine disagrees. The passage connecting my rooms to the main halls of the estate are magnetron-designed, made of steel walkways with open sides. Some run along the ground, but many arch over the leafy treetops, jagged rocks, and springs dotting the property. Should battle ever come to our door, An invading force would have a difficult time fighting their way through a structure set against them. Despite the manicured forest and luxurious grounds of the ridge, few birds come here. They know better. As children, Ptolemus and I used many for target practice. The rest fell to my mother's whims. More than 300 years ago, before the Kalor kings rose, the ridge did not exist, and neither did Norta. This corner of land was ruled by a Samos warlord, my direct ancestor. Ours is the blood of conquerors, and our fortunes have risen again. Maven is not the only king in Norta anymore. Servants are good at making themselves scarce here, appearing only when needed or called upon. In recent weeks, they seem almost too good at their job. It isn't hard to guess why. Many Reds are fleeing, either to the cities for safety against civil war, or to join the Scarlet Guard's rebellion. Father says the Guard itself has escaped to Piedmont, which is all but a puppet, dancing on Montfort's strings. He maintains channels of communication with the Montfort and Guard leaders, albeit begrudgingly. But for now, the enemy of our enemy is our friend, making us all tentative allies where Maven is concerned. Tali waits in the gallery, the wide open hall running the length of the main house. Windows on all sides offer a view in every direction, over miles of the rift. On the clearest of days, I might be able to see Petaris to the west, but clouds hang low in the distance as spring rains race the length of the sprawling river valley. In the east, valleys and hills roll off in increasingly high slopes, ending in blue-green mountains. The rift region is, in my correct opinion, the most beautiful piece of Norta, and it is mine, my family's. House Samos rules this heaven. My brother certainly looks like a prince, the heir to the throne of the rift. Instead of armor, Tali wears a new uniform, silver-gray instead of black, with gleaming onyx and steel buttons, and an oil-dark sash crossing him from shoulder to hip. No medals yet, at least none that he can wear. The rest were earned in service to another king. His silvery hair is wet, plastered back against his head, fresh from a shower. He keeps his new hand tucked in close, protective of the appendage. It took Ren the better part of a day to regrow it properly, and even then she needed an immense amount of help from two of her kin. "Where's my wife?" he asks, looking down the open passage behind me. "She'll be along eventually, lazy thing. Tali married Elaine a week ago. I don't know if he's seen her since the wedding night, but he hardly minds. The arrangement is mutually agreed upon." He links his good arm in mine. "Not everyone can operate on as little sleep as you." "Well, what about you? I've heard all that work on your hand has led to some late nights with Lady Ren," I reply, leering. "Or am I misinformed?" Tali grins, sheepish.
"Is that even possible?"
"Not here. In Ridge House, it's near impossible to keep secrets, especially from Mother. Her eyes are everywhere, in mice and cats and the occasional daring sparrow. Sunlight angles through the gallery, playing across many sculptures of fluid metal. As we pass, Ptolemus twists his new hand in the air, and the sculptures twist with it. They reform, each one more complex than the last. "Don't dawdle, Tali. If the ambassadors arrive before we do, Father might spike our heads to the gate," I scold him. He laughs at the common threat, an old joke. Neither of us has ever seen such a thing. Father has killed before, certainly, but never so crudely or so close to home.
"Don't bleed in your own garden," he would say.
We wind our way down from the gallery, keeping to the outer walkways so as to better enjoy the spring weather. Most of the interior salons look out on the walkway, their windows polished plate glass, or their doors thrown open to catch the spring breeze. Samos guards line one, and they nod their heads when we approach, paying deference to their prince and princess. I smile at the gesture, but their presence unsettles me. The Samos guards oversee a violent operation, the making of silent stone. Even Ptolemus pales as we pass. The smell of blood overpowers us both for a moment, filling the air with sharp iron. Two Arvins sit inside the salon, chained to their seats. Neither is here willingly. Their house is allied to Maven. But we have need for silent stone, and so they are here. Ren hovers between them, noting their progress. Both their wrists have been slit open, and they bleed freely into large buckets. When the Arvins reach their limit, Ren will heal them up and stimulate their blood production, all to begin again. Meanwhile, the blood will be mixed with cement, hardened into the deadly blocks of ability-suppressing stone. For what, I don't know, but Father certainly has plans for it. A prison, maybe, like the one Maven built for Silvers and Newbloods both. Our grandest receiving chamber, the aptly named Sunset Stretch, is on the western slope. I suppose now it's technically our throne room as well. As we approach, courtiers of my father's newly created nobility dot the way, thickening with every forward step. Most are Samos cousins, elevated by our Declaration of Independence. A few of closer blood, my father's siblings and their children, claim princely titles for themselves, but the rest remain lords and ladies, content as always to live off my father's name and my father's ambitions. Bright colors stand out among the usual black and silver, an obvious indication of today's assembly. Ambassadors from the other houses in open revolt have come to treat with the Kingdom of the Rift, to kneel. House Iral will argue, attempt a bargain. The Silks think their secrets can buy them a crown, but power is the only currency here. Strength, the only coin, and they surrendered both by entering our territory. Haven has come as well, the shadows basking in sunlight, while the Loris Windweavers in yellow keep close to each other. The latter have already given their allegiance to my father, and they bring with them the might of the air fleet, having seized control of most air bases. I care more about House Haven, though. Elaine won't say it, but she misses her family. Some have pledged loyalty to Samos already, but not all, including her own father, and it tears at her to see her house splinter. In truth, I think it's why she didn't come down here with me. She can't bear the sight of her house divided. I wish I could make them kneel for her. In the morning light, the Sunset Stretch is still impressive with its smooth river rock flooring and sweeping views of the valley. The Allegiant River winds like a blue ribbon over green silk, lazily curving back and forth into the distant rainstorm. The Coalition has not arrived yet, allowing Tali and me time to take our seats. Thrones. His on Father's right, mine on Mother's left. All are made of the finest steel, polished to a mirror sheen. It's cold to the touch, and I tell myself not to shiver as I sit. Goosebumps rise on my skin anyway, mostly in anticipation. I am a princess, Evangeline of the Rift, of the royal house of Samos. I thought my fate was to be someone else's queen, subject to someone else's crown. This is so much better. This is what we should have been planning for all along. I almost regret the years of my life wasted training only to be someone's wife. Father enters the hall with a crowd of advisers, his head dipped to listen. He doesn't speak much by nature. His thoughts are his own, but he listens well, taking all into consideration before making decisions. Not like Maven, the foolish king who only followed his own flawed compass. Mother follows alone in her usual green, without ladies or advisers. Most give her a wide berth, probably because of the 200-pound black panther padding at her heels. It keeps pace with her, breaking from her side only when she reaches her throne. Then it weaves around me, nuzzling its massive head against my ankle. I keep still out of habit. Mother's control of her creatures is well practiced, but not perfect. I've seen her pets take bites out of many servants, whether she willed it or not. The panther shakes its head once before returning to Mother, taking a seat on her left, between us. She rests a single hand blazing with emeralds on its head, strokes its silky black fur. The gigantic cat blinks slowly, its yellow eyes round. I meet Mother's gaze over the animal, raising a single brow. Hell of an entrance. It was the panther or the python, she replies. Emeralds flash across the crown of her head, expertly set into silver. Her hair falls in a thick black sheet, perfectly straight and smooth. I couldn't find a gown to match the snake. She gestures down at the jade folds of her chiffon dress. I doubt that's the reason, but I don't say so out loud. Her machinations will become apparent soon enough. Smart as she is, Mother has little talent for subterfuge. Her threats come openly. Father is a good match for her in this way. His maneuvers take years, always moving in the shadows. But for now, he stands in bright sunlight. His advisors fall back at a wave of his hand, and he ascends to sit with us. A powerful sight. Like Ptolemus, he wears clothes of brocaded silver, his old black robes abandoned. I can feel the suit of armor beneath his regalia. Chromium, just like the simple band across his brow. No gems for Father. He has little use for them.
Cousins of Iron, he says quietly to the sunset stretch, looking out on the many Samos faces dotting the receiving crowd. Kings of Steel, they shout back, putting fists to the air. The force of it thrums in my chest. In Norda, in the throne rooms of Whitefire or Summerton, someone always crowed the name of the king, announcing his presence. As with gems, Father doesn't care about such needless displays. Everyone here knows our name. To repeat it would only show weakness, a thirst for reassurance. Father has neither. Begin, he says. His fingers drum on the arm of his throne, and the heavy iron doors at the far end of the hall swing open. The ambassadors are few, but high-ranking, leaders of their houses. Lord Solon of Aral seems to be wearing all the jewels my father lacks. His broad collar of rubies and sapphires stretching from shoulder to shoulder. The rest of his clothes are equally patterned in red and blue, and his robes billow around his ankles. Another might trip, but in Aral silk has no such fear. He moves with lethal grace, eyes hard and dark. He does his best to measure up to the memory of his predecessor, Ara Iral. His escorts are silks as well, just as flamboyant. They are a beautiful house, with skin like cold bronze and lush black hair. Sonia is not with him. I considered her a friend at court, as much as I consider anyone a friend. I don't miss her, and it's probably for the best she isn't here. Solon's eyes narrow at the sight of my mother's panther, now purring beneath her touch. Ah, I had forgotten. His mother, the murdered Lady of Aral, was called the Panther in her youth. Subtle mother. Half a dozen Haven shadows ripple into being, their faces decidedly less hostile. In the back of the room, I notice Elaine appear as well, but her face stays in shadow, hiding her pain from everyone else in the crowded room. I wish I could seat her next to me, but even though my family has been more than obliging where she is concerned, that can never happen. She'll sit behind Tali one day, not me. Lord Gerald, Elaine's father, is the leading member of the Haven delegation. Like her, he has vibrant red hair and glowing skin. He seems younger than his years, softened by his natural ability to manipulate light. If he knows his daughter is in the back of the room, he doesn't show it.
Your Majesty, Solon Iral inclines his head just enough to be polite.
Father does not bend. Only his eyes move, flickering between the ambassadors.
My lords, my ladies, welcome to the Kingdom of the Rift. We thank you for your hospitality, Gerald offers. I can almost hear my father grind his teeth. He despises wasted time, and such pleasantries are certainly that.
Well, you traveled all this way. I hope it is to uphold your pledge.
We pledged to support you in coalition, to supplant Maven, Salin says. Not this. Father sighs.
Maven has been supplanted in the Rift, and with your allegiance, that can spread.
With you as king, one dictator for another. Mutters break out among the crowd, but we remain silent as Solon spits his nonsense. Next to me, Mother leans forward. It's hardly fair to compare my husband to that addled prince who has no business sitting his father's throne. I won't stand by and let you seize a crown that is not yours, Salin growls back. Mother clucks her tongue. You mean a crown you didn't think to seize yourself? Pity the panther was murdered. She would have planned for this, at least. She continues, stroking the glossy predator at her side. It growls low in its throat, baring fangs.
The fact remains, my lord, Father cuts in. While Maven is floundering, his armies and resources vastly outnumber our own, especially now that the Lakelanders have bound themselves to him. But together we can defend. Strike out in force. Wait for more of his kingdom to crumble. Wait for the Scarlet Guard. The Scarlet Guard!
Gerald spits on our beautiful floor. His face colors with a gray flush.
You mean Montfort. The true power behind those wretched terrorists. Another kingdom.
Technically, Tali begins, but Gerald presses on.
I'm beginning to think you care not for Norta, but only for your title and your crown. On keeping whatever peace you can while greater beasts devour our nation.
Gerald snaps. In the crowd, Elaine flinches and shuts her eyes. No one speaks to my father this way. The panther snarls again, matching Mother's rising temper. Father just sits back against his throne, watching the open threat ripple through the sunset stretch. After a long, trembling moment, Gerald sinks to a knee.
My apologies, Your Majesty, I misspoke. I did not intend—
He trails off under the king's watchful eye, the words dying on his fleshy lips.
The Scarlet Guard will never take hold here, no matter what radicals may be backing them.
Father speaks resolutely.
Reds are inferior, beneath us. That is the work of biology. Life itself knows we are their masters. Why else are we silver? Why else are we their gods, if not to rule them?
The Samos cousins cheer.
Kings of steel! Echoes through the chamber again. If new bloods want to throw their lot in with insects, let them. If they want to turn their backs on our way of life, let them. And when they return to fight us, to fight nature, kill them.
The cheer grows, spreading from our house to Laris. Even a few in the delegations clap or nod along. I doubt they've ever heard Volo Samo speak this much. He's been saving his voice and his words for the moments that matter. This is certainly that. Only Solin remains still. His dark eyes, rimmed with black liner, stand out sharply.
Is that why your daughter let a terrorist go free? Why she slaughtered four silvers of a noble house to do so?
Four Arvin sworn to Maven. My voice snaps like a whip crack. The Eral Lord turns his gaze on me, and I feel electrified, almost rising in my seat. These are my first words as a princess, my first words spoken with a voice that is truly my own. Four soldiers who would take everything you are if their wretched king asked. Do you mourn them, my lord?
Solon scowls in disgust. I mourn the loss of a valuable hostage, nothing more, and obviously I question your decision, princess.
Another drop of derision in your voice, and I'll cut out your tongue. The decision was mine, Father says evenly. Like you said, the Barrow girl was a valuable hostage. We took her from Maven, and loosed her on the square like a beast from its cage. I wonder how many of Maven's soldiers she took with her that day. Enough to fulfill Father's plan, at least, to cover our own escape.
And now she's in the wind, Solon implores.
His temper slips, inch by inch. Father shows no signs of interest and states the obvious.
She is in Piedmont, of course, and I assure you, Barrow was more dangerous under Maven's command than she'll ever be under theirs. Our concern should be eliminating Maven, not radicals destined to fail.
Solon blanches.
Fail? They hold Corvium. They control a vast amount of Piedmont, using a silver prince as a puppet. If that is failure, they seek to make equal that which is not fundamentally equal.
My mother speaks coldly, and her words ring true.
It is foolish, like balancing an impossible equation, and it will end in bloodshed. But it will end. Piedmont will rise up. Norta will throw back red devils. The world will keep turning. All argument seems to die with Mother's voice. Like Father, she sits back, satisfied. For once, she is without her familiar hiss of snakes. Just the great panther purring under her touch. Father forges on, eager to land the killing strike.
Our objective is Maven, the Lakelands. Cleaving the king from his new ally will leave him vulnerable, mortally so. Will you support us in our quest to rid this poison from our country?
Slowly, Salin and Gerald exchange glances, their eyes meeting across the empty space between them. Adrenaline surges in my veins. They will kneel. They must kneel.
Will you support House Samos, House Loras, House Larolan?
A voice cuts him off. The voice of a woman. It echoes from nowhere.
You presume to speak for me?
Gerald twists his wrist, his fingers moving in a rapid circle. Everyone in the chamber gasps, including me, when a third ambassador blinks into existence between Eral and Haven. Her house appears behind her, a dozen of them in clothes of red and orange like the setting sun, like an explosion. Mother jolts beside me, surprised for the first time in many, many years. My adrenaline becomes spikes of ice, chilling my blood. The leader of House Larolan takes a daring step forward. Her appearance is severe, gray hair tied into a neat bun, her eyes burning like heated bronze. The older woman does not know the name of fear.
I will not support a Samos king while a Kalor heir lives.
I knew I smelled smoke,
Mother mutters, pulling her hand back from the panther. It immediately tenses, shifting to stand as its claws slide into place. She just shrugs, smirking.
Easy to say, Laurentia, now that you see me standing here.
Her fingers drum at her side. I watch them closely. She is an oblivion, able to explode things with a touch. If she got close enough, she could obliterate my heart and my chest, or my brain and my skull.
I am a queen. So am I.
Annabel Larolan grins wider. Though her clothes are fine, she wears no jewelry that I can see, no crown, no medal. My fist claws at my side.
We will not turn our backs on my grandson. The throne of Norta belongs to Tiberius the Seventh. Ours is a crown of flames, not steel.
Father's anger gathers like thunder and breaks like lightning. He stands from his throne, one fist clenching. The metal reinforcements of the chamber itself twist, groaning under the strain of his fury.
We had a deal, Annabel,
he snarls, the Barrow Girl for your support. She just blinks. Even from the far side, I can hear my brother hiss. Have you forgotten the reason the guard has Corvium? Did you not see your grandson fighting his own in Archeon? How can the kingdom stand behind him now? Annabelle doesn't flinch. Her lined face remains still, her expression open and patient. A kindly old woman in everything but the waves of ferocity emanating from her. She waits for my brother to push on, but he doesn't, and she inclines her head. Thank you, Prince Ptolemus, for at least not furthering the outrageous falsity of my son's murder and my grandson's exile, both committed at the hands of Ilara Mirandis, both spread through the kingdom in the worst propaganda I have ever seen. Yes, Tiberius has done terrible things to survive, but they were to survive. After every one of us turned on him, abandoned him, after his own poisoned brother tried to kill him in the arena like a base criminal, a crown is the least we can give him in apology. Behind her, Iral and Haven stand firm. A curtain of tension falls over the hall. Everyone feels it. We're Silvers, born to strength and power, all of us trained to fight, to kill. We hear the tick of a clock in every heart, counting down to bloodshed. I glance at Elaine, lock eyes with her. She presses her lips into a grim line.
The rift is mine, Father growls, sounding like one of Mother's beasts.
The noise shudders in my bones, and I am instantly a child. It has no such effect on the old queen. Annabelle just tips her head to the side. Sunlight glints down the straight iron strands of her hair gathered at the nape of her neck.
Then keep it, she replies with a shrug. As you said, we had a deal.
And just like that, the coiling turmoil threatening to engulf the room sweeps away. A few of the cousins, as well as Lord Gerald, visibly exhale. Annabelle spreads her hands wide, an open gesture.
You are the king of the rift, and you may reign for many prosperous years. But my grandson is the rightful king of Norta, and he will need every ally we can muster to take his kingdom back.
Even Father did not foresee this turn. Annabelle Lerelin has not been to court in many years, electing to remain in Delphi, her house's seat. She despised Ilara Mirandis and could not be near her, that or she feared her. I suppose now, with the Whisper Queen gone, the Oblivion Queen can return. And return she has. I tell myself not to panic. Blindsided as Father may be, this is not surrender. We keep the rift. We keep our home. We keep our crowns. It's only been a few weeks, but I'm loath to give away what we've planned for, what I deserve.
I wonder how you intend to restore a king who wants no part in a throne, Father muses.
He steeples his fingers and surveys Annabelle over them.
Your grandson is in Piedmont.
My grandson is an unwilling operative of the Scarlet Guard, which in turn is controlled by the Free Republic of Montfort. You'll find that their leader, the one calling himself Premier, is quite a reasonable man. She adds with the air of someone discussing the weather.
My stomach twists, and I feel vaguely sick. Something in me, a deep instinct, screams for me to kill her before she can continue.
Father raises an eyebrow. You've made contact with him?
The Lerelin Queen smiles tightly.
Enough to negotiate, but I speak to my grandson more often these days. He's a talented boy, very good with machines. He reached out in his desperation, asking for only one thing, and thanks to you I delivered.
Mare. Father narrows his eyes.
Does he know of your plans, then?
He will.
And Montfort?
is eager to ally themselves with the king, they will support a war of restoration in the name of